Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's in with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? I hope you're all keeping well. It's September. Where has this year gone? Crikey. But I hope, yeah, I do hope you're all keeping well. And thanks for all the messages for the incredible episode from last week with the wonderful Giles Torreira. Just the most loveliest fella. I'm so pleased he came on. And what I wanted to do, it's not a companion piece, but it kind of is, because there's a connection with this week's guest. It's the fantastic playwright, Roy Williams. I don't know why I was pausing there. I know his name. I've recorded it. He is incredible. I've been a big fan of Roy's work for years. And it's a slightly different episode this week than normal. Of course, it's individual because it's a different guest. But the way that it's structured, we don't tend to talk about Roy's trajectory too much. We don't talk about growing up in Notting Hill because, and I'm pointing you to another podcast here, the Royal Court podcast with Simon Stevens. He's had incredible writers on there. Do go and check it out. But the episode with Roy is really interesting because Simon does go right back to growing up in a single parent family with, I think, three or four brothers and sisters who are older, how he, you know, he wasn't doing great at school and he got inspired by somebody else to start writing. So what I want you to do is go and check out that podcast and you'll hear about Roy's upbringing. And it's really interesting. But I didn't want to cover that again because someone's already done it. Instead, I was focusing more on the structure of his writing, a typical writing day. We focus a lot on a great, great play that, as you'll hear in the episode, stuck with me still now. I was really thinking about it, called Sucker Punch with Daniel Kaluuya at the Royal Court. If you didn't see Sucker Punch, you don't know what we're talking about, do go and read a review of Sucker Punch and look at some images. I think it'll really help with this episode, with what myself and Roy get into with the whole design of the play. And we talk about Death of England. We briefly talk about Fallout because of the connection with Lenny James and Daniel Ryan, who are past guests of the podcast. If you haven't heard those episodes, what are you doing? Go back through the timeline, get on Daniel Ryan and the incredible two-parter that was King Lenny James. That's kind of all we need to know, I think. And the connection, as you'll hear, is Death of England, which started out with Rafe Spall at the National, moved on to past guest Michael Balogun. What? You haven't heard that episode? Come on. Go back, it's in the first year, Michael Balogun, what a belter. So anyway, Giles Torreira Here's the connection. Giles Torreira was originally cast of in the part of Delroy, Death of England, Delroy, which is the second of, at the moment, is a trilogy. But now he is playing that role again, but in the third part, which is going to be a two-hander that they've shot. It's Giles Torreira and Neil Maskell. And it's, yeah, they filmed it. They filmed it at the National. So it's kind of a hybrid. We did discuss it last week with Giles, and we briefly touch on it this week with Roy. It's neither theatre nor film. It's some sort of hybrid in between, and that's going to come on Sky soon when I've got a TX, an air date. I'll let you all know, and we can all watch it together. Yeah? Great. So let's get down to it. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the fantastic Roy Williams. Enjoy. I shall see you at the end.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Oh, brilliant. See, that's so much better. Because if we can't do these things in person, which, you know,
yeah.
I mean, we're slowly getting back to doing it. I can't wait, to be honest, because... Let me just check I'm recording. Yes, I am. We're all good. Because I spent so many years sitting down with a pot of tea, possibly a cake, in front of somebody, seeing the whites of people's eyes. And seeing, you know, because the great thing, what I've learned about doing this, because I was so nervous about starting this years ago, is you just read the body language. And whether, you know, sometimes we're touching on quite sensitive subjects. And if you can tell if people don't want to go there, with what they're doing, without them telling you. Do you know what I mean? It's just so fucking helpful. And I don't want to get into that sort of mindset of just doing it like this, because it takes away that human aspect. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I'm all switched off, Roy. That's good. We'll throw that down there. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. Very well, thank you.
You look very well.
Thank you.
And no doubt, I'm sure, during... this time you've been ferociously busy.
I have been, yeah. It's been pretty, I mean, it generally has been busy for me, you know, not showing off or anything, but, you know, but has been, but particularly since the world just went to shit.
Well, I see, that's the thing, really, because, really, you know, busy. As an actor, we're constantly relying on people like yourselves and, you know, producers to give things the green light. And predominantly, because I do a lot of filming more than theatre, but everything involves collaboration, and
we can't
get together and collaborate and work together. But as a writer, as a playwright, you're your own boss. You know, you're.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's
to a certain extent, obviously.
Absolutely.
With regards to work, you can start, you can get it down, can't you?
Yeah, because I had so many people as well saying to me, the first lockdown must have been, you know, easy for you because, you know, you're at home, you're writers, you traditionally work from home. And I said, yeah, to a degree, that is true. But I'm nothing without inspiration. And particularly that first lockdown, there was nothing to inspire me. It was just turn on the news, couldn't go out, couldn't see anybody. I mean, that's when it was really draconian. You can only go out for an hour.
Yeah.
And then come back home. And then on the news, it was COVID, COVID, COVID. So there was nothing.
Turn off the news, try and get inspired. And just, yeah. There was a time when I just couldn't. I had to turn the radio off. I had to turn the television off. I had to try and explain to my then 9-year-old kind of what was going on with my limited knowledge of what I was being drip fed. And it's like, I really don't know at the moment. Yeah. And it's really hard. Because what
it was really hard. And, but I kind of told myself, you know what, be patient, because I think we as human beings, I mean, there's an old saying about storytelling, and in essence, that's exactly what I am, a storyteller. Mm. We all want to be told a story somehow in some form. And we want to be told a story. We want to tell a story and be told a story. I sometimes take that stage further. I sometimes feel we as human beings, we need to be a story. We need to be active. We need to be doing something, regardless of what it is. So I just kind of felt, okay, I'm going to wait. Something's going to happen. This it's not going to just be this. And in May, something did happen. Something awful, tragic, and had worldwide repercussions. And that was obviously the murder of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And as a black man, I was shocked, sickened. But then also as a black man, I was cynical because I thought, okay, here we go again. People are going to use the usual protests and such, but it's going to die away.
Yeah.
And then another poor bastard is going to happen to him again. Not just in America, but here as well. Let's not pretend it doesn't happen here. But I was struck, really struck by the worldwide, response to it. People marching, Black Lives Matter everywhere.
Yeah.
All points of the globe. That blew me away. That really astonished me. But I'm convinced that was because of COVID. I think that by then people had had enough. They just said, we just got to go out. We just got to do something.
Do you think if we weren't in a pandemic and the awful tragedy of George Floyd that did happen, do you not think what would have happened, the aftermath? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I mean, at first I thought, it's because of COVID, and if it wasn't for that, he would have been just another black man who died. But there was something struck me about this younger generation of ours, because it's hard for me to admit, because I'm in my 50s now, and I kind of think, okay, we're the old, my generation, we're the old farts now. And I haven't got children, but my brothers and sisters do, and my friends do, and kids like I knew when they were babies, they're all in their 20s now, and they're all going out, they're all working, they're all voting, and there's something different about them. I remember there was one sign during the whole protest, and actually my niece took part, and she was interviewed on Sky TV, and I was so proud of her. She was 14 years old and so articulate.
Wow.
Go girl, well done. But there was a sign someone held up, and they said, you fucked with the last generation. And I just thought, oh, okay, it's a bit sentimental, but I love that energy. I love that attitude. Just
and
that,
also,
you fucked with us last year. No more. And I thought,
I know what I was doing at 14, and it wasn't being articulate and going on a protest like that. So, you should be proud of her. My God. And,
I've just got to blow my nose.
Go for it.
Sorry.
But I think that's right. They have fought with the last generation, and they are more articulate. They do. They've got something to scream about now.
They've got something between their teeth.
Yeah,
they really have. And it's them. I would say Greta Thunberg. I think she's of that generation. And wow, there's a young girl. How old is she now? 16, 17, putting adults to shame.
Oh, I mean, sometimes I know people go on about a younger generation and go, well, look at their role models. What are their role models? Or sort of reality TV stars, that much, not much a role model. But wait a minute. There is so many incredible role models out there, which is why they now have a voice.
Absolutely. And Marcus Rashford as well. What astonishing
of course,
young man.
Oh, my God, the stuff that he has done, especially where I am, in the north now. I mean, they're just incredibly proud. There was an amazing sign that was put up during lockdown one, and I think it went viral, and it was all done here in Manchester. And I actually know the lads that did it, and it said Johnson 0, Rashford 1. And it was just up on the motorway, and it just went off.
I like that. I was touched by the mural that was defaced after, the Euros. And, I mean, who didn't see that coming? I mean, I was watching it here at home with my nephew and my partner. And as soon as as soon as Saka missed that penalty, I just thought, yep, we know what's coming in. sure enough, the tweets arrived. And I thought, yep, stop the clock. It's happened. And Rashford's was mural, I think, was defaced.
Yeah, it was.
And then the guy who originally painted it, he went back, did a touch-up job. And then the community just came out and put... I mean, wow, that was... I haven't seen that before.
I mean...
That
was... It isn't,
you have to be made of stone not to be touched by that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we go on about... I was talking to Giles Torreira last week about it, actually.
Hey, my man.
About, you know... And not that this is a pandemic podcast whatsoever, but we have to talk about sort of change and things like this. And, you know, what you're touching on there is a community spirit that is alive and well. And so many people, you know, maybe they didn't talk to each other, but now.
Now they are.
Slowly but surely. Look, we are all here and we are coming together for one purpose, to do this. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it was it was so heartwarming to see.
It gives me hope. Well, really does it. For us. It really did.
If there's anything that we need, it's hope. And it's little things like that.
Yeah,
that,
absolutely.
That prove that it is alive and well.
Totally.
But Roy, let's just go back to writing and creating. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you say, you know, yeah, it's all very well and good that people say to you, well, you're a writer. That's what you do. You're alone for the majority of the time, unless you're collaborating with somebody, which I'm sure we can move on to later. But it's not necessarily easy because everything's shut. So it's like you're saying you need the inspiration, but if there's no inspiration there, how can you get your stories down?
Oh, with great difficulty, and I'm speaking for myself when I say that. But I kind of rely... Inspiration for me comes from anywhere. It can come from something, a conversation I overhear. And... It can be something that we're talking about that really enrages me and also makes me laugh as well. It just gives me an emotion. When I often go to the theatre, actually when I go to the cinema as well to see a film, all I want is three things, just three things. I want to be surprised. I want to learn something. And I want to be moved. Just give me those three things. And some of my best experiences in film and theatre sometimes have been when someone's just only achieved one of those things for me.
Yeah.
It's very rare I get all three.
Absolutely.
Rare.
I mean, again, I think it was Giles I was talking to last week about theatre, and I was saying, you know, not 9 times out of 10, that's a bit harsh, but let's say 5 times out of 10, I go and see a piece of theatre that I'm looking forward to seeing, and maybe I try not to delve too deep and know too much about what I'm going to see. And then... I go, oh, well, I'm slightly disappointed because I can see that they've stolen that from X. They've taken that from there. I've seen Punch Drunk do that. I've seen Complicité do that about 10 years ago. So please don't try and make it your own. But one piece of theatre that always struck me and still sticks with me now, and I was thinking about it the other day when I knew that we were talking, was Sucker Punch.
Oh, okay.
And never again, and nor will I ever probably see... The downstairs of the Royal Court just turned into a boxing ring. Now, for those that didn't see it, I suggest you just look that up because that was a ferocious evening out. I mean, it was like being at a ballet because it was so beautiful.
Oh, it was more than believe me, when I was writing it, I did not expect Miriam Buther, the designer, to turn the Royal Court inside out the way she did.
Well, I was going to say,
I wasn't expecting that.
That must have been quite a hard pitch to go, this is what we're going to do.
I know. I would love to have been the fly on the wall for that one. She got her own way, and it was incredible.
So when you wrote it, you didn't write it as when I went to see it, with the design? No.
No, it was just a simple. I just said boxing gym. In the script, it was just a boxing gym. I didn't. Wasn't it?
Nobody really was a boxing gym.
It really was. Absolutely. And funny enough, a production happened a couple of years ago in LA, and they did it in a boxing gym. They did it the other way around. They configured a boxing gym into a theatre.
Wow.
I didn't get to see that one, and but no, that was just it was just incredible what the work that Miriam and Sasha Wares, who directed the play, did.
Absolutely, yeah,
and the guys as well, the actors were just phenomenal. Anthony Welsh and some actor,
Dan,
not quite sure what he's up to now.
Bless him. He did well.
He did all right. I think he won an award a couple of months ago. Oscar or something, maybe.
Right. But, like, the training that those lads did, they look like athletes.
They were incredible. I mean, it's funny because I remember, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, but when he came in for the audition, Daniel, I've known him since he was a kid. I've always known him as quite a podgy kid. Phenomenal actor, however. I mean, I saw him play earlier at the called Oxford Street, and he absolutely upstaged everybody. And he came in, he read, and he's a writer's dream. Because I love actors who come in with the attitude, I'm here to solve your problem. It's me. I'm here. I've got the script. I've done my homework.
Yeah.
And more importantly, he just got the beats of the. He didn't learn it, because that drives me mad sometimes. I have to say, no offense, when actors try to learn everything in audition. Because I want to say to them, you don't have to do that.
No, I say that all the time to younger actors. Also, just going back to your point of, oh, I'm here to solve your problem. I always say, go in, because they've got a hole to fill, and it's you.
Yeah, we don't want to be sitting there all day drinking stale coffee.
You want to get on with it and start building this jigsaw, and then you can take it into the rehearsal space. Hmm. But just going back to the auditioning then, it's so hard for younger actors nowadays because they're told you need to be off book, you need to learn these eight pages. And I always say to them, when you're going in for theatre, you need to be malleable anyway. You need to play around and you're going to get things thrown at you. Don't be comfortable. Exactly what you're saying. Do your homework. Know your character. But this is the start of building the character.
Absolutely. Yeah, the director exactly. They want to see how you take direction. They want to have fun with you. But Daniel came in and he did everything right instinctively. He didn't go to drama school. He just did it instinctively. Mm. And he just got the rhythm of my words. And he was just phenomenal. And when he left, I mean, Sasha said, well, we've got to cast him in the play. Interesting enough, at the time, we were seeing him for another part in the play. And she said, okay. And so we had him on shortlisted for that part. A real strong favourite. Mm. And then she called me that very night and she said, Roy, I've been thinking, I think we should offer Daniel the lead. And I said, you sure? But why? Because, as much as I love Daniel, but I did panic a little because, one, he didn't look like a boxer as well. And also, as good as he was to carry that play, because his character never leaves the stage, is a phenomenal ask. But she just said, I think he can do it. I really think he's got something. And she just said, because if we cast him in the other role, he's going to upstage the actor we end up getting playing the main part. So let's give it to him. And then they just got him on a sort of three-month regime of training. I mean, they were above and beyond, those guys. They really were. It wasn't just a simple, you come in for 4-week rehearsals. They were on it 3 months before. They got into training with boxer from the 80s called Errol Christie, who sadly is no longer with us. He died a couple of years ago, and he really put them through it. Put Daniel, Anthony, and Jason Mazza really through it. And Daniel just slimmed down. He lost about 3 stone.
Yeah, I mean, they looked incredible. I mean, that's like movie training when you're going to be on camera. It's kind of unheard of to start a 3-month prep before you start a 4 or 5 week step into the rehearsal space for theatre, isn't it?
I know, and to this day, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was a big ask of them, but they were up for it. They really said, no, let's do it. And I think that added to it. I think that added to the show's success. And just because there was a real bond between those guys. And then with the other cast members who came later, Sarah Ridgway.
Nigel.
And Mr. Lindsay.
Yeah,
Nigel,
of course. Lindsay.
He was a Don. He was our captain.
Yeah, of course.
He led from the front. He's a delightful man to work with.
But they looked authentic. We're telling a service in the play, but we're telling a story, but we're being truthful. And my God, they looked as authentic as could possibly be.
They did.
Flab a fat on them. And they looked like boxers. They looked like they're throwing punches. And then, that's why I was referring back to when it was so graceful and elegant that it looked like a ballet at times, as well as being, it was just fucking incredible. And that's why a piece of theatre like that And I'm not just saying this because we're on, but it's a good idea to talk about it because you're my guest and it's important. But
thank you.
You know, yeah, it's one of those pieces of theatre that has stayed with me and struck me at the time.
Oh, thank you. It stayed with me as well. Mm. It was a tough play to write. It's when I look back on the writing of Brian, that play, it gives me inspiration for whenever I suffer from writer's block now, because I always remind myself, Roy. Remember, how long did it take you to write Sucker Punch? You think, yeah, good point. Because there were times when it kept going back into the proverbial bottom drawer because I couldn't lick it, I couldn't get it, I couldn't make it to work. Couldn't get past a certain stage. The story just wasn't advancing enough for me. And also, I reached a stage, and this is a good lesson for me as a writer and also a good lesson for any potential writers who are listening. It was a lesson for me. One of my hobbies, Craig, is as well as writing, is photography. I love photography. I love taking pictures. And there's a wartime photographer called Robert Capa. He died many years ago. And he was asked a question once. Robert, Mr. Capa, what's the difference between a bad picture and a good picture? And he said, a bad picture is when the person taking the picture is not close enough to the subject. You've got to get closer. And I kind of took that on board and kind of, you know, inferred it into my sort of into writing. The reason why I was going wrong with Sucker Punch was I wasn't close enough to the subject. I used to go to a youth club in West London, because like West London's kind of where I grew up, not in Hill, not in Dale. And it's a club called the Rugby Club. And they had a boxing club there. And me and my mates used to watch some of our mates fight, you know, and do amateur boxing. And actually, I put this in the play. I remember I was like larking about in the gym with one of the guys, and he hit me, and then I hit him back, and it's quite a sort of swift uppercut. And then the guys, the manager, the trainer who ran the gym, saw me and said, all right, get these gloves on. Let's see what else you can do. And I got into the ring, and had a fight with another kid who battered the life out of me. Yeah. And I thought, that's it. I'll watch it from the armchair from now on. Thank you very much. So I was using all of those experiences to write the play, and it was only getting me so far. And then I realised, what am I doing? I'm writing a play about boxers in the 80s, and I haven't met any. So I called the Royal Court, told them, you know, this is my problem, and they knew someone who knew someone who knew someone who knew John Conte, who I remember. I used to watch him fight when I was a kid. And he came into the court, we had lunch, and we spoke for about 3 hours. And he just told me lots of stuff I didn't already, you know, probably already knew, but it was just interesting just hearing it from him who lived it.
Yeah.
His career as a boxer, the racism he endured as well. And just more importantly, it was the little things like, you know, how he puts on a glove, what's his training regime workout, and the banter between other guys in the gym and so on and so on. And he just fed me loads of stuff, and I went away, and that really kind of really gave me a real good tailwind to really, to hit the next draft and deliver something that I was happy with that the Royal Court could see. And thankfully that was the draft they decided, yeah, we're going to go with this.
So tell me about the commissioning process then, because obviously the Royal Court were on board whilst you were writing. So what did you have to give them to inspire you and put the faith in you that you were going to deliver?
Well, I need to go back a little bit because, the Royal Court were one of the theatres I established a relationship with. And this was the time, and yeah, it doesn't exist as much now, and I wish it did, is when theatres, they didn't just invest in a playwright, they just established a relationship with you. Yeah, if they saw something of you written and they like you, you know, they'll invite you in. And that's what the Royal Court did. I mean, I remember, I got a phone because I sent them my play, play that I wrote when I was at college. And they called me in. I met Graham Wybrow just for a general chat. I met Stephen Daldry, who was artistic director at the time. And I was put on the writers group. And then, and more importantly, I was given free tickets to see plays. They have writers' nights for every time a play opens.
Yeah.
So a relationship was built. And they didn't just, you know, immediately commission me. They eventually did to write a play, which they turned down, and they were right to because it was crap. But then I wrote two up. I got my mojo back by writing another one, which they did, and they did. But what was great about it, in between all the two plays I wrote from before, by then, Ian Rickson had taken over the courts. Mm. And even before my first play for the court, which was Liftoff, had opened, already he said, okay, Roy, let's get a date in the diary. Let's talk about what you're going to write for us next. It was just assumed you're going to write another play. They didn't care how well or badly that play was going to do. They just said, no, you know, you're going to write another piece. And the same thing happens after Clubland.
But that's them investing in you as a writer. They're investing in the writer. Yeah. They're not investing in what's coming up or what's going to be a hit. They're investing in you. I know there's other theatres that do this, but it's quite specific for the Royal Court because it started out as the writers' theatre.
Exactly. You know, I couldn't have asked for a better home to be kind of to be more or less to be brought up. So by the time, it was after my second upstairs play, and again Ian Rickson took me downstairs into the downstairs space, and we had our meeting there. And then that's when he said, okay, I think you're ready to write a play for the downstairs space. And I got so excited. That's one of the happiest days of my life. Because as a playwright, by then, I knew what that meant. When you have a play downstairs, is your name up in lights in Sloane Square.
It must be every writer's dream. I mean, everybody knows that very famous shot of Look Back in Anger outside Sloane Square, and then you see Our Country's Good, Timberlake, Wharton, Baker, and you go, oh my God, that could be me. It's super exciting. It's so simple, but so classic. It's such an iconic sign outside.
Yeah, because the writer comes first. And that was amazing. And he finished the meeting and he said, look, stay here for as long as you like. Just soak it up, soak it all in. So, yeah, and that's what I did. I soaked it up. And I had a really good think about what I wanted to write about. And that's when Sucker Punch was conceived in my mind, really. But like I said, it took me that long until I realised I need to speak to some boxers.
Yeah. But is it the way with that? Did you feel, or is it the way, that by having your production upstairs, it's a trial to come downstairs? Because, I mean, for those that have been to the Royal Court, these are two very, very different spaces.
Yes.
So what you would write for upstairs wouldn't necessarily translate for downstairs and obviously vice versa. But is that the way that it's kind of a trial to...
I don't know if I use the word trial, but I think I know what you mean. But, yeah, absolutely. It just without sort of being formally taught, you do learn about space and stuff. And I very much learned a lot from that. I'm still learning to this day. It's the very different spaces. But neither one of them, I would say, is limited. I think you should, playwrights should allow whatever space you're writing for to inform the work you want to do. And, you know, try very hard not to see it as being limited, because it doesn't have to be. No. I've seen some incredible pieces upstairs. So actually, I've seen some better pieces, with all due respect to the court, than I have downstairs.
Me too. And I've seen that upstairs been transformed. And I remember walking up one time going, I don't even feel like I've walked upstairs. I've walked something completely different. Oh, it's all down to fucking the incredible designers and crew that work there.
Oh, the stunning.
Do you feel... as much part of the casting process? Because I know that the writers are very much involved, certainly with the Royal Court. But if you moved to the National, let's say, for instance, is it that same feeling that you have control as you do at the Royal Court, or certainly have a voice?
Certainly have a voice. I take pride in the fact that I've sat in on pretty much most, if not all, auditions that have been for my plays over the years. But I like to think of myself, I'm respectful of the director. And I always say to him, it's your call, it's your final call. I use it for me, actually, when I sit in auditions, because it's an opportunity for me to hear the play in advance.
Yeah.
And also what's fun about it is you see how different actors approach it. I always find that really a good lesson. Just to see, do they all trip up on that line? If so, okay, there's a problem with that line. I need to do something about it.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah,
I'm like that. Even when I go and see my plays, you'll find me watching the audience more than watching the play, because I always feel I learn a lot from them.
Oh, absolutely.
Just in terms of how they move, and are they engaged in that bit? And I try to take as much as that on board as possible. But auditions, I enjoy it. But, you know, I used to be an actor myself, so I'm kind of aware of, the rules. I wouldn't be as... I try not to make it sound as formal as that, but you know, that's the best word I can say. But yeah, there is, you know, it's a director's call, so it's their space, so I let them do all the talking. And yeah, I mean, and most directors value my opinion. They just say, "What do you think of that person? That person?" And sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes when the actor comes in, no disrespect to them, you just know within 10 seconds they're not right. And I tell this, that I've been to drama schools like yourself, and I've told younger writers, say, younger actors, I should say, is you'll be amazed the reasons why you don't get a job. And it's got fuck all to do with how good you are.
Yeah.
It's other crazy logistical reasons why you don't get a job. So, you know, it's all about don't take it personally, for goodness sake.
Yeah. How are you with rejection? Because you spoke before about when the court knocked back one of your plays, and by your own admission, you did say it was crap. So how are you with rejection? Because if you're put in, I don't know, let's... 6 months into a first draft, or however long it may be. I don't know. Obviously, I'm not a playwright, but you've worked hard, you've researched, you've done a lot of homework, you've got it down. It's got to a point where you're passing it over for someone to read. And then they go, no.
It's hard. It's still hard to hear. And make no mistake, it still happens, no matter what stage you're at. I mean, I remember, I won't give away the playwright's name, but I had lunch with them a year ago during, I think, you know, during the second or first lockdown. And they apologised for not coming to see my play at the National. And I said, why? He said, well, they turned my play down. And I nearly spat my coffee out. I said, what, you? They turned you down? He goes, yeah. And he was still very sore and bitter about it.
Wow.
But I understood that. I've felt that way when I've had plays turned down by theatres as well. It is difficult. I remember... I think I handle it a lot better than I did when the court turned my first play down, because I think at that time I came off the back of, I think it wasn't long after Staudry started, and he managed to find this generation of new young playwrights. A lot of them, you know, big, you know, kind of established playwrights now. Myself, Jonathan Harvey, Mark Ravenhill, so many others, Rebecca Pritchard, Judy Upton. Oh, so many. David Eldridge came about. Joe Pennell came on in that era. A lot of Simon Stevens.
Yeah.
That generation. He found a lot of those names. And my name kind of sort of came off the back of it. So I felt quite chuffed. I felt quite sweet. And you know, my name is listed along those other writers. To the point, I wasn't expecting a rejection. I wasn't quite prepared for it. As I said, they were right to turn it down. It wasn't a very good first draft. And I remember, because at the time I think the Royal Court were they're in the West End while Sloane Square was being rebuilt.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
And I met literally Magic Graham in when they were based at the Ambassadors, and I took a long walk to Hyde Park, sat on a bench, cried my eyes out. Absolutely, I was desperate. It was. I just let it all out. I was in floods of tears. And then, I went to bed, woke up the next day and just said, okay, well, it can't get any worse than that. And it hasn't, in spite of I've had, you know, rejections and so on. But, I mean, where I've come around to thinking of it at the moment, this is how I deal with it. And this is what I often told younger writers. Well, I'm sorry to say this. This may sound blunt, but it's their right not to like it.
Of course.
Sorry. It's their right not to get it. More importantly, it's their right not to get it. Yeah. Yeah. They won't see that what you've written is the next, I don't know, All My Sons or yeah. You know, or whatever. Yeah. They don't get it. It's their right to be stupid.
If you have to sit down and explain it to them, then maybe you haven't done your job. It's like sitting down and explaining a joke to somebody and wanting them to find it funny. Maybe it's the joke, or it's the teller of the joke.
That's an excellent way of putting it. It's our right. It's people's right not to get a joke. They just don't get it, and that's the way you've got to accept it, and then you move on.
But also, as you say, you sat on that bench and you let it all out. But it's important to acknowledge the rejection. Not necessarily. I say to younger actors all the time, as you say to younger writers, there's going to be a lot. There's going to be more rejection than you know. The door's going to be open, come in. But it is important to sit with it and don't think you're just going to climb back on the horse straight away. Give yourself a bit of time. It's important to have a bit of grieving time. Break. You've worked really fucking hard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, that's what I say to them. That's what I say to myself. I just say, yeah, no, you busted your ass writing this piece. Yeah, they don't get it. You take a deep breath and you take it somewhere else. And I've lost count. And it's happened to me and so many other writers where you take a play to another theatre and they get it and they put it on. Yeah. There's one play. Again, I won't get into specifics. I'll tell you about this another time when we meet up. I'll tell you in private over a bottle of wine or something. But there's one theatre who, I mean, I remember they discussed this certain play and absolutely dissed it. Completely dissed it. Thought it was utter crap by this writer who they felt should have known better.
Mm.
I've never met this other writer, I didn't hear, but he did. He took it to another theatre and it was a massive success. Big hit.
You can't please everybody.
You can't please everybody.
And
no.
Everybody has different taste, and as well they should, because otherwise what a boring world and a boring artistic world we would live in if all theatre was the same and all film was the same and all storytelling was to come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, just believe in yourself, believe in your work, and listen to yourself and be honest, because that's not an easy thing to do, but I think you have to. I really had to admit to myself, okay, that play they rejected wasn't any good. And but conversely, the other plays, I think I've had sort of two rejections. And those plays I do believe in. I did believe in. I said, okay, fine. They didn't get it, but I do believe in this play. I honestly do. Yeah, it still needs more work, but I still believe in it. And you take it there. And then, but interesting, I mean this is what's fun and so daft about this industry as well, because again, I won't mention the play, but I've written one play. There's one play in my back catalogue that should never have got put on. It wasn't ready, and we kind of got away. I kind of got away with it.
Did you feel that at the time, or is this with hindsight?
I did feel that at the time. It wasn't ready. It wasn't ready, and I should have said to them, "Can I have another year?" And but there's nothing I can do about that now. But there's plenty I can do, like with future work, and really just remember that and just sort of say, you know, don't rush myself. And what was about rushing? It was just don't be arrogant, Roy. Because I think a slight arrogance of my part came in, thinking, yeah, I can do this, I can sort this. And then, but you know, the inner voice was saying, yes, I know you can, but you know, give yourself time. You're not giving yourself time here.
Yeah, I mean,
and I should listen to that inner voice.
Confidence is key, and confidence is important. And I always think if it tips into arrogance, then you need to have a sit down and have a little word with yourself.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
in every sort of
very much, just, so,
just
very much
not
so.
Even in this business. I just think in life, full stop.
Yeah, you know. But I think I mean that play I'm talking about. I mean, that was quite a while ago, but I still remember. That feeling.
Do you think that time is key to when a play is put on or when a play is written? Because I'm trying to think, like Fallout happened at the opportune time, and obviously when it translated to telly.
Yeah,
but then again. Sadly, if you put Fallout on now, would it be as relevant?
I don't know. I think it would be, because sadly, it's still happening.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah,
it's still going on. I like to think, but I didn't think about any of those things at the time. And I mean, an overall point, I think, about what you're saying is, someone once said this to me once years ago when I was at college. You know, a new play isn't finished until the last night. So it's still evolving. It's still growing to be played. It's not a complete play until the very last night.
Absolutely.
Just still finding things. I find, and that was certainly the case with Fallout. I mean, that went through so many drafts, in spite of the subject matter.
Mm.
And that was an interesting kind of leap from doing it from a play to a TV film. That took a while, mostly because. It went through so many. I mean, one film company had the rights to it, and I did a script for them. It didn't work out, and before you know it, 2 years of development and writing it for a huge amount of time has passed, and then it came to the point when another production company expressed an interest, and I went with them, and they're the ones who ended up producing it, but that was interesting. Just because I remember writing it, I remember how I had. the text of the play here and the kind of blank page here. And it was a real interesting lesson in terms of what the camera can do for you in terms of telling the story. Like, you know, I didn't need that big speech by that Shanice has on page 37. A zoom in on her eyes tells all I needed to know. And I got a lot of help with that, with the producers and script editors in that. And that was fun to do. And it was even more fun because Ian Rickson, as well as doing the stage version, he did the film version.
Yeah.
And he did a, and yeah, him, Ian being Ian, he did a marvellous job.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you've got Lenny there as well.
Oh, don't get me started on him. I love that man. Really love that man.
When you're talking about that, for instance, then, that we don't need that speech and we can just zoom in as she tells the story. Was it easy for you as the writer to lose something that maybe you really loved?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was that old, Mamet coined the phrase, is, you know, kill your babies. Which I always hate. They're always just kind of think, oh, piss off.
Yeah.
It's a good line. You know, work me arse off to kind of think of that line. You're just telling me to put a red line for it. No, on your bike.
Yeah.
But there is some logic in terms of what he's saying, really. And it was that, really. It's just like, you know, what can the camera do for you? And actually, it's quite therapeutic, actually, putting a red cross through the dialogue and scenes that that were in the play that we couldn't transpose. I remember the ending gave us a headache, trying to, how do we come out of this? How do we come out of this? Because the end, you know, it seems easy, but the ending we had for the play didn't quite transpose over to, we filmed it as the play did.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that was it. I think that's when the genius of Ian came in, because I think I couldn't think of it. And he said, look, let's just film it. Let's see what we got in the edit. And hopefully a bit of inspiration will come to us in terms of where we ended it.
Yeah.
And it was just a simple thing. It was just the main character, Shanice, just she's made peace. She's at peace with herself. She's made her confession, which actually wasn't in the play. I wrote that. And she goes to the boy's parents and asks for forgiveness. And the mother, beautifully played by Noma Dumezweni.
Oh, my God. Another
actor who's kind of disappeared. What's she up to these days?
I wish she would come back and do something and grace our screens and our stages once more. My God, whatever happened. I mean, what all these cats, such amazing, beautiful people that you work with.
I emailed her once and just said to her, okay, do I have to write a play for you to get you back? And she laughed. And I thought,
yes.
She said, do it, Roy, do it. I said, I'm going to hold you to that.
Yes.
I'm going to write a play for them. I'm going to hold her to it. I'm going to write it. I'm going to say, right, get your ass back here.
I am not editing that out, Roy Williams.
No,
do we
don't,
have this
don't you dare.
Now? I will be there for opening night.
Absolutely.
Go on.
Sorry, go on.
No, please. The end of Fallout.
Yeah, the end. And it was just a simple, she goes and sees Noma, asks for forgiveness, and Noma gives it to her. And then we see her on the bus. And again, no dialogue. It's just her sitting there. You're just going to think, a weight's been lifted. Not completely, but a weight's been lifted. She's matured. And then we see her go fade out on the bus. And I thought, that's it. That was perfect.
It's so interesting because there's so much strength in silence on screen. And you can just sit with it for as being as brave as you can as a filmmaker and let the audience.
Do you know what it reminded me of? I think I told Ian at the time. I hope I did. It's the most brilliant ending to any film was Long Good Friday.
Oh my God, yes.
When Bob Hoskins at the back of the car and Pierce Brosnan's pointing a gun at him and he goes through every single human emotion because he knows this is it.
Yeah.
I'm on my way to my death. And I just thought, oh, that was genius. And it's one of those moments where I kind of think, who came out with that first? Was that Bob Hoskins or was that the writer? I'm on the side of the writer. I would just say, oh, no, it was a writer. But it probably wasn't. It probably was like the actor or the director kind of thought that up. But then, you know, it wouldn't have happened unless, you know, Barry Keith's genius words weren't there for Bob Hoskins to speak.
Absolutely. And let's put it down that it was a collaboration between all three of them.
I'll go with that.
That's what I would like to think. Roy, I want to talk about you as a writer and would you have a typical writing day? I know everybody has different things. Are you structured with, you know, are you going to get up at 6, you're going to work 6 till 12 and have a break? How does that work? Or does it depend on piece to piece?
It really isn't a piece of piece. What's common is I do get up very early. I can get up at 6. And, I can work to about 9. I live opposite a school. I kind of set my day around as kids.
Right. When the school bell goes, you clock out.
That's it. I go downstairs for another cup of coffee. Yeah. And that's about as close as I get. I mean, I faff around as well early in the morning. I might catch up on a box set or something I've missed on iPlayer. I might watch that for an hour. Or sometimes I can waste a good hour on YouTube. Sorry.
Who can't?
Yeah. Just nonsense, absolutely. You know, when it's cats falling out of trees or just anything, I waste my time. And
oh, Roy, have you watched The White Lotus yet?
Oh, yeah, we devoured it. We watched it all. I think we watched them all in one night.
One night, you masochist. What an incredible piece of telly.
Oh, God. It was just... I was hearing about it. We were hearing about it, and then we just watched it. Within 10 minutes, we were in.
Yeah.
It's one of the best openings. I just thought, that's it. I'm in.
Yeah, quite extraordinary.
It made me squirm.
Yes.
Because I've encountered people like that before.
Oh, and the conversations sure
was, oh my God. And just thought, this is incredible. And the acting was superb. I mean, I wish I could remember his name, because I always like to big up actors who do amazing performances. But the guy who plays the manager.
Hotel manager. I can't remember his name either. I mean,
what a star.
It was, you know, they talk about, oh, well, this was the performance that opened the doors to the world for a certain person. I think this is it for him. And forgive me, I will do some research and I'll put his name in the intro or the outro so we know and we can sort of big up who we're talking about. Because, yeah, and also Jennifer Coolidge.
Being, oh, my God, she was fantastic.
Just fantastic. Heartbreaking and monstrous and hilarious.
Everything. She
it's
was
everything.
Everything.
Just so I know we've gone wildly off topic, everybody listening, I don't want to give any spoilers away, and neither does Roy, but do go and watch The White Lotus where you can, and it'll hopefully it might inspire you to
hear.
Well, just be a better person, probably. Just jumping forward now to the present, certainly with Death of England, was it conceived as a trilogy? Because obviously I know there's going to be three separate chunks. Am I allowed to say that there's three at the moment?
Yeah, you can say it, yeah.
Okay, only because I know. I've just got massive inside information because I know everybody.
So. Oh, yeah, because of a certain Mr. Maskell, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And of course of, you know, Giles and Clint, so...
Of course. I think that came about because we did the original 10-minute film for the... Because we were commissioned, if I may, I was commissioned along with other writers to write short films for The Guardian, sort of co-production between them and the Royal Court.
Mm.
And we were commissioned to write films that were inspired from the pages, the supplements that we get in the Saturday Guardian, i.e. music, sport, fashion, politics. And I went with sports. And then the idea I came up with was a football fan at a funeral of his father. So, and then became... The football, the beautiful game was a really good metaphor for where I felt where we were at that time as a country.
Yeah.
And I think it was 2014, and that was the first time the word Brexit started being uttered.
Right.
And so Clint came on board to direct that short film. I've known Clint for years. He's, you know, as an actor and as a director, and I love working with him. And he just said, you know what, there's more here. We can do more here. So jump forward a couple of years later, we were at the National Theatre Studio and we got a bunch of actors in. And Clint, because I know because he's worked with Mike Lee, he likes that kind of the way Mike Lee finds characters. So we did a lot of that just in terms of to build a story up, you know, the funeral was still going to be centrepiece, but then we wanted the other characters, you know, his relationship with his dad, his sisters, his best friend Delroy, and so on. And we just got these great actors and we filmed them. And we had so much to go away to write a first draft. And I think I panicked him a little because I said to him, it's too much here. It was, I think it's like the most biggest play I've ever written and co-written. And I just said, it's, you know, it's too fat. It's just too big, mate. But I've got an idea. Can we write it as a one person play? So we don't lose anything, but tell it all through the character of Michael. So I said to Clint, look, let me go away. Let me write a draft and show you. So I did that, and he loved it. And then he took over and he wrote a draft. And it's funny between us, because we never formally said, let's write this play together. We just, it just seemed right from the very beginning that we do it.
And it was just organic like that.
It felt organic. Right. Felt organic because, I mean, Clint and he grew up in the East End. I grew up in West London, and both our kind of how we grew up and our knowledge of the white working class. And because, yeah, most of my mates when I grew up as a kid in the area I lived in were white and working class and Irish as well. So I grew up with a level of understanding, and as did he. So it just felt two heads were better than one, and I'm glad we did. I mean the play was fantastic because we both did it together. I really believe that. So like I said, so I went away. He did another draft, and then we pitched it to National. They loved it, and then Rafe thankfully came on board, and that was also the first time when it felt almost at times. Even though our names are on it, mine and Clint, but Rafe had a hand in it as well. And it was right to do it that way because it's just him on stage. I mean, what he did on stage every night, I watched in wonder of him, just like, how the hell can you keep that level up on your own on the stage? My God. I mean, he was a soldier.
Well, sadly, I didn't get to see it, but I had good friends that did see it and said it was, they've never seen anything like it before.
I felt it was important for my part. We should give up a little bit of ownership to the play to Rafe because he's carrying it on his own. So in rehearsal, I think we gave him a lot more say in stuff.
But also that's like, it's what we were talking about at the beginning. Mm. It's this is like true collaboration. This is a true collaboration trifecta between three artists there.
Absolutely.
Yourself, Clint,
absolutely.
And Rafe. That's,
and it worked. Yeah. It served the piece. That's what I feel it did. We all served the piece. So that was a really great way of working. And it's funny because I've often been asked by other people, particularly writers, is it good working with someone else to write a play? And I just said it's got to feel organic first. Yeah. You've got to be of one mind almost on the play. Yeah. It's not just about you just coming together.
And certainly in this scenario, one voice. His voice. But yeah, I mean, if it's... Mm. I always think if you have to try and push or it's not working, then maybe it's not meant to be.
Exactly. And the fact that, Clint co-wrote it and directed it, I mean, he is an extraordinary, amazing director, and I'm so glad he's getting his due now.
Yeah.
And it's bloody well deserved because he's top, top.
No, me too. Yeah, he's an extraordinary talent and a fantastic bloke to boot.
Which
certainly for collaboration, I always tell people, just don't be a dick. Don't be a dick.
he's one of those. I've been blessed working with directors, but he's definitely got that. He's never said it out loud, but he's definitely got that kind of aura. Like I don't have time for dickheads in the rehearsal room.
No,
if you're a dickhead on your way, get out. And he's got a very good dickhead from Omitar on his head. Like
absolutely. I was working earlier this year on I'm not really allowed to say, but something that was it's very well loved. BBC show, a lot of respect to it. And I was sat down with the producer and me and this other actor I was working with, and we were just talking about the origins and the genesis of the show. And he went, the one thing that we just always have and we pride ourselves on is we just don't cast dickheads because we've got no time for it.
We
pride ourselves, this is a really nice place to come and work and everybody has a laugh, but we always get the job done. And we don't employ dickheads. And it's like, well, if we're going to collaborate, everybody wants to do, everybody wants a collaboration. Mm. You need to collaborate with people that are sound. So first and foremost, it's like Kathy Burke said, turn up on time, know your lines. And she said, don't be a cunt. And she's right,
I love that. I love that. But I mean, it's funny because as a writer, I don't, from a distance, I think I've been quite blessed. I haven't worked with dickheads.
No.
However, but I don't work. I'm not as close as with actors as I am as the directors I worked with are. And more often than not, I've heard different stories about certain actors I worked with, and they just say, "Well, he was a nightmare, or she was a pain in the ass." And I think, really, I like them, really, actually. So, but yeah, but from my point of view, I haven't encountered that, and I want that record to continue.
don't we all?
I just don't have time for it. I don't have the energy for it. Really.
No, and you know, from the other side of it, neither do we as working with, you know, directors who think it's all about them and it's not about the piece. You know, again, it goes back to collaboration. It's exactly. Let's go back to the beginning, and where did it all begin? Mm. It began with what's in front of us or what we're holding in our hands, and that's the script.
Completely. Absolutely. Know?
So from Death of England, did you feel you wanted to... obviously, you did, because you did it, but when did it come about that you thought, yeah, we need to go to Delroy now?
Well, it's funny, because Clint and I think it was in the National Theatre Bar, we were just talking about all the other stuff that we didn't use, all the other unfilmed, the film stuff we filmed. There was so much there, because we thought, there's enough of two or three plays, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, a bit of a scoopy in terms of what the next play is going to be about. There were some lovely scenes we filmed between Delroy's the actor playing Delroy and the actor playing Carly. There's some really nice, intimate, really lovely moments between them, which we didn't end up using. I mean, there's a bit of that in the first play and a little bit more in the second one, but there's still acres more. And so, and then we just randomly spoke about, oh, you know, we could do another play. And then somehow in the conversation, we decided it was going to be about Delroy. And then I think Emily, who worked at the National at the time, overheard our conversation. And then we went downstairs because we were doing like a pre-show talk. And then she outed us. She just sort of said, we want you to write another play for us because I think you've got ideas. And we just went, oh, all right, then we will.
Brilliant.
And it was kind of, I think it was edging that way anyway.
Yeah.
So, but it was nice to sort of have it confirmed in front of many, many witnesses.
And having not seen Death of England with Race, I did catch on the television, but it was, and I was so proud of Michael, but it was such a blistering performance from him.
Again.
You know, he must have, and for those that don't know, and I'm sure you did hear from, I don't know if me and Giles spoke about it on last week's episode. Anyway, Giles Torero was originally cast to play Delroy and sadly had to drop out to have the operation. And then Michael Balogun, who I interviewed in the first year of this podcast, on his first or second job at RADA, which anybody hasn't listened, you should definitely go back and listen to that. It's a very good episode. But to see him step up and take control of this role, you just went, well, who's plays Delroy? Michael Balogun is playing Delroy.
It was the same thing I had when Rafe, I watched Michael, and particularly because he has such less time to step in, but he did an incredible job, and it was curtailed sadly by COVID because our opening night was our last night. Well, that's not strictly true. We did have 2 weeks of previews, and he was getting a standing ovation on every performance, and well deserved.
Yes,
absolutely, really well deserved. I mean, it's if I just go back and it wasn't our intention to have the play on that year. I mean, that took me by surprise. Wow, I've had two plays on the National in 1 year.
Yeah.
That's just almost unheard of. It was because of the restrictions we were going through. And then when the George Floyd thing happened, I think that really motivated Clint and I to really... We really speeded ourselves up because we just felt this is important. In terms of, you know, what the world and what everyone's talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. It goes back to what I was talking about, time as well, right? Mm. The time is now, yeah.
And then Rufus had a word with us and said, look, you know, nothing guaranteed, but there's a chance we can reopen in October. And we want to reopen this. And, you know, I was amazed and speechless. And then I think I nearly passed out then when he said, oh, it's going to be on the Olivier. And I went, come on, come on. Seriously? Oh, my God, because it's... oh, it's still a special space for me. I mean, I think it means a lot to everybody, but to have your play open there, Jesus Christ.
But it's also a huge space.
Yeah. I remember doing a tech. I love techs. Yeah. So I know some playwrights don't, you know, because, you know, you're not needed, but I love it. I just love seeing all these people working to deliver what you've written.
Mm.
And I loved it. And I love nothing better than sitting back and watching them at work. It's great. So when we were teching Devon Delroy, I sat right at the back of the Olivier's the dress circle. And I remembered, I said to myself, you know what? This could very well be the same seat I sat in when I was 17, when I came here. First time I stepped foot in the National Theatre, I came to see Threepenny Opera with Tim Curry playing Matt the Knife.
Wow.
And it was a party of us because I was studying A-level drama at the time and Threepenny Opera was one of the places we were studying. So we all got free tickets to come and see it. So we all sat in the back row. And I said, wow. I mean, obviously, there's no way I could know for certain if that was the same seat, but I do kind of remember where I was. And that was a really weird, eerie feeling. Just thought, wow, well, Roy, you've come a long way, haven't you?
But also, that I find that really romantic. That's beautiful, you know?
Mm. It was really nice. It was really nice. That made my day. I thought of that. Mm.
It's those lovely moments you can just sit back. And also, you're in the tech. You know, right now, your work is done. You can just sit back and watch everybody else start putting the jigsaw together. And you've got
great.
That feeling.
It's...
And that's so lovely to keep your feet on the floor to go, fucking hell, Roy, yeah, I've come a long way here. This is it's come full circle. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I hope, you know, you saw younger playwrights, so, you know, I hope they have an experience similar to that, because it's all good. It really is.
Do you think there's a time when... Part one and part two, as I'm calling them, even though they're not, of Death of England, could work together, could play in, and I'm not a theatre director, or not. Could they come and play in rep? Because I thought what would be really interesting was to see both of them on the same day.
I think again, we were restricted by a pandemic. There was a strong conversations we were having about that happening.
Mm.
But obviously the world as it is prevented it. Yeah, I mean, as much of the success I've had over last year, I've had a few knockbacks, you know, like everybody else. Two revivals of two of my plays were curtailed because of the COVID. Sucker Punch was going to be done again, and Sing Your Heart Out for the Lads, even though that production of Sing Your Heart Out was done the year before at Chichester and was done phenomenally.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to see it. I had very little to do with that. I just showed up, and I'd forgotten I'd written it. It was just so good. It was so amazing.
Wow.
Nicole Charles, who directed it. So I just thought, you star. You absolute genius. But yeah, there has been discussions about doing it in rep. But I'm hoping those discussions haven't gone away. I know Clint's busy getting Marley ready. And we just filmed specially written film that brings the two characters from the two Death of England plays so far together. So it's not quite a play. It's kind of like a film. I wouldn't say it's Death of England 3. It's more like Death of England 2.5.
Right.
Because then once Clint's come up for air, we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about the final play, the final chapter.
Fab. Well, I absolutely can't wait, and I'll be there. Well, now theatres are back and reopened. I'm setting foot in them. Roy, what an absolute fucking pleasure talking to you. I feel I think we've got a lot more to cover. So I think maybe we should come back on and revisit this in a few months.
Oh, love to. Yeah, yeah, do me in. Absolutely. Well, let's meet up soon.
Let's meet up in the real world.
Yeah. Who's your team, by the way? Just out of you. I like to ask people. Your footy team. Do you have one or do you follow?
I'm from Blackpool, Roy.
I don't
follow football, my friend. But you did mention a glass of wine before when we meet up, so we'll have a glass of red wine.
Oh, we'll do that.
We'll
do that.
My love of everything sport. It'll last 2 minutes.
Cool.
We'll talk about something else after that. Roy Williams, you've been an absolute star. Thank you very much, my friend. Cheers.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? He's such a ray of sunshine, Roy, and he's honest. His honesty about failure and rejection is really important to hear, whether you're an aspiring writer or not, or whatever career path you follow. We all meet a fork in the road with rejection, and sometimes it's hard to deal with, you know? So thank you to Roy for being so candid and an absolute joy to listen to. And, you know, that was, I don't know if we mentioned it, that was the first time we've met. We were trying to work out if we'd met before through other people. I think our paths have crossed, but that was the first time that we sat down for a good hour or so and chatted. And I think I said after we stopped recording, it's still, you know, warms my heart where, you know, because I'm slightly nervous. I've never met anybody, these people before. Is the conversation going to flow? Are we going to get on? And it did. And I love it when it does. And it makes me really happy. And I hope it made you happy too. Yeah. And when, you know, when you feel comfortable, get back to the theatre, support your local theatres. And if you see a play that is penned by Roy Williams, I suggest you go and see it. Or maybe go to your local bookshop and pick up one of his plays and give it a read. He's a phenomenal writer, and as you can hear, a fantastic, fantastic person. As I'm really thrilled that Roy came on. Massive thank you to him, and a massive thank you to you for supporting us, as you do, week in, week out. You know we're on Patreon. If you can support us there, chuck us a few quid. These podcasts are free. We put a lot of time and effort into them, whether it's, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to book the guests, sort the dates out, grifts hard with the tech stuff, you know, so whatever you can do, maybe you can afford it this month, maybe you can't. Either way, thank you so much. You say lovely things on social media. That's great. You remember, word of mouth is key. So do us a favor, will you? Go and tell a handful of friends about this podcast and see if you can get them to subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review. I know. Yeah, leave us a 5-star review. That helps. If you want to say something decent, that's great too. Social media is fantastic for getting word out. Or maybe you want to go old school and you want to send us a lovely email. We love reading them. We don't read them out. It's not Steve Wright on Radio 2. We're not going to flog about, oh, you know, your podcast is so great. Yeah, it's fine. We know that you love it, and we're grateful and we're thankful for that. But you can, if you want, drop us an email. It's twoshotpod@gmail.com. See? I wasn't doing that slow. I remember it all the time. It's, you know, you don't know your own email. That's it, I think. Anything else? No? Okay. I'll tell you what. Why don't we all meet back here next Thursday? Can I tell you who it is yet? No. I don't think I can. He's a director, and I'm looking forward to it. I haven't recorded it yet, which is why I'm not telling you. But I'll see you here next Thursday. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff, and this has been The Two Shot Podcast. Thanks a lot. Take care of yourself. I'll see you next Thursday. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.